Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for July's Emergency Club webinar. I'm delighted to welcome our speaker for today, diplomat of the American College of Veterinary Emergency and Critical Care, Garrett Pachtinger. Thank you, Garrett. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with everyone today. Hopefully my audio is coming in nicely. And I wanted to thank everyone for joining me, whether this is the live version or whether you're watching after the fact. And the main goal that I have when delivering content, whether live and on a podium and a stage or online, is I want to provide clinically relevant and practical content. So that's what we're going to focus on tonight. We're going to talk about a global approach to the common effusions we see in small animal medicine. We're going to take an approach to the identification, the safe sampling techniques, evaluation of these effusions, and of course, common differentials when we have a patient that has effusions to improve our knowledge and our patient care, of course. So again, thank you everyone for joining us, and I hope this is a helpful presentation for you. There are many types of and causes of effusions and many locations of effusions that we see in small animal medicine. In the session today, we're going to focus on four major effusion locations: pleural, peritoneal, pericardial, and retroperitoneal. And the first type of effusion that we're going to review is pleural effusion. I see a ton of pleural effusion cases in my clinical practice, and what we see when they have this pleural effusion is a rapid, short, and shallow breathing pattern due to reduced chest compliance. And if I can really give you a take-home point, if there's really only one take-home point you leave with during this session, because this certainly is a life-threatening condition, this is a diagnosis I would like you to make based on the visual appearance of that patient and auscultation. Use your stethoscope, use your eyes, use your clinical skills. My soapbox comment is that I never want you to diagnose clinically significant pleural space disease on x-rays, on radiographs. I'm going to talk about that a little bit more on the next slide, but that's my take-home point. Don't diagnose clinically significant pleural space disease on radiographs. When you auscult them, when you use your stethoscope, you're going to find a reduced resonance, or in other words, dull lung sounds within the thoracic cavity. Often these patients are uncomfortable. They stand or kind of sit upright. They don't want to lie down. They have that short and shallow respiratory pattern. Their head and neck may be extended. Their elbows are abducted. They are doing everything in their power to breathe more comfortably because they're in that much distress. So going back to that soapbox comment before that I said, I never want you to diagnose clinically significant pleural space disease on x-rays. Why do I say that? Taking a look at this x-ray here, think about the patient that is attached to that x-ray. Do you think that patient is comfortable? Do you think they're in respiratory distress? The last thing they want is to be taped, held down, or sandbagged down to that table for an x-ray. They're in distress. They're very stressed and anxious. Secondly, how does this x-ray help you? I hope you're already going to know with your auscultation, with your stethoscope, there's going to be dull lung sounds and likely pleural space disease. But when I look at this x-ray, I can't see the heart well. I can't see a fair bit of the lung cavity well. So this x-ray, to me, from a clinical approach, is fairly useless. It's a clinical waste to me, and it puts that patient at significant risk to decompensate. Another take-home point: how much pleural effusion is actually important? Well, here are my numbers on the slide here. You need approximately 10 mils per kg of fluid to result in radiographic detection of pleural effusion, and approximately 20 to 30 mils per kg of effusion to result in an altered physical exam. So this to me is more important than a fun fact that I'm going to bring up at a party to impress my friends. Let's think about it from a clinical standpoint. If you have a standard 5-kilogram cat, and I told you that you need at least 20 mils per kg of effusion to result in an altered physical exam, 5 kilograms times 20 mils per kg, I'm saying to myself, if I'm going to perform a thoracocentesis on that patient, I need 5 times 20, or approximately 100 mils of effusion to make a clinical difference. So if I'm doing a thoracocentesis, and I only get off 45 mils, and they're still dyspneic, I'm saying to myself, well, did I miss a pocket of effusion? Or is there something else going on aside from pleural effusion? Is it pneumonia? Is there cancer? Is there other pulmonary parenchymal disease, pulmonary edema, for example, that we're dealing with? So whenever you perform a thoracocentesis, use that magic 20 mils per gig and say, okay, did I get enough off that it makes sense? Or is there something else that may be going on for that specific patient? So how are we going to get that sample? If I am worried about a patient with pleural effusion, pleural space disease, and they're dyspneic, how can we safely get that sample? Well, again, hopefully our auscultation cells says that we have those dull lung sounds ventrally, and of course, looking at them, they're in distress. What is our next step? Not x-ray, right? I just said we're not going to take an x-ray on that patient. It's too stressful. We're going to perform a thoracocentesis. So let's talk about that. As we can see in our diagram here, the main goal is to go between approximately the 8th and 10th intercostal spaces. When we are between 8 and 10, that's caudal to the heart, which sits between the approximate 4th and 6th spaces, and cranial to the diaphragm, which is around 12 and 13. So we should really avoid those major structures. 8 and 10 is right in the middle. So let's look at a clinical patient where I'm doing a thoracocentesis. So I like to have my patient in sternal recumbency. Why? Well, number one, in sternal recumbency, usually they are more comfortable if you lay them in lateral recumbency. So I'm trying to tap this cat on the left side. So let's say I lay them down on their right side in right lateral recumbency. Number one, then maybe in quotes, their good lung is now consolidated or atelectatic because it's down. And number two, where's the fluid? It's fallen away from you because of gravity. So sternal recumbency is better for the procedure itself, but also better for the patient. So that's why I like them in sternal recumbency. As you see here, I've clipped up a nice wide area between the 7th and 11th or so, so wider than my 8th or 10th for nice aseptic technique to reduce contamination. So we've clipped and we've scrubbed the area. What's my general setup? It depends on the patient itself. Typically, something like a 21 to 22 gauge needle, if it's a normal size, non-obese cat, maybe a butterfly can be helpful, but they're usually around 5/8 inch in length. And so if you do have an obese cat, and let's face it, many of our feline patients aren't the most healthy body condition scores, a butterfly catheter may not be helpful. But essentially, we have our needle hooked up to some sort of tubing, hooked up to a three-way stopcock, and then our syringe. In cats, I rarely use a syringe greater than approximately 20 mils because let's just say it's a 5-kilogram cat. Again, 5 times 20 is 100. If I use a 60-mil syringe, number one, that's hard for me to handle by myself alone with one hand. But you also apply a significant amount of pressure when you aspirate, when you suction, and that can actually collapse the tubing. If it's a big dog and I know there's a liter or two in there, sure, you have a different opportunity to use larger gauge needles and also larger syringes. But for a cat, standard cat, I would say 20 mils per kg. And then once we have our patient prepped, we have our needle and stopcock and syringe already, where are we going to enter? Well, remembering that fluid is gravity dependent and ventral, we're going to stick that needle perpendicular into the chest on the ventral third of the chest, which is, of course, the right place for fluid. If I was worried about, for example, a pneumothorax, air rises, so we'll go on the dorsal third, but pleural effusion, as we're talking about effusion now, we're going on the ventral third of the chest. Once we get that sort of pop, when we enter our needle into the pleural space, then I'll start to apply some gentle negative pressure and aspirate fluid, and I will aspirate fluid until I get negative pressure, making sure I try to evacuate any and all fluid for both comfort and diagnostic ability from that pleural space. After we obtain our sample of fluid, what are we going to do with it? Sure, yes, my main goal to start, I want it to be therapeutic for that patient. I want that patient to breathe better, more comfortably, and not be in that much distress. So that's our goal to start. We want a therapeutic result, but we need to get the diagnostic part of it as well. So in an attempt to get our diagnosis, and of course then better treat our patient long term, we're going to have to evaluate that fluid. How are we going to do that? Well, listen, there's a couple of different options. We're going to look at the sample, the gross nature with our eyes. What does it look like? What color? Is it turbid? But then we have to do some fluid analysis that is a little bit more objective, and part of that's going to be cytology. And I actually like doing cytologies myself. Like many of you, I'm in the trenches. I don't sit up there on the ivory tower just giving everyone else orders. I'm in the ER. The ivory tower is not my place. So I want to know what I'm dealing with. So even if I am going to send it to the reference laboratory for a board-certified clinical pathologist to review, sometimes I don't want to wait that 24 or 48 hours or maybe longer, if it's a weekend, for example, to know how am I going to better treat that patient. So even in the ER myself, I will take the opportunity to at least get a cursory assessment. What does it look like to me? And therefore, how can I better treat that patient? So I'm going to play a video now of how I like preparing a cytology from the fluid we obtained, and I'll explain as we go through it. So this is not a sterile sample. So we have our just general bowl of effusion, and I'm going to suck it up in a 3 ml syringe. And then your machine may look a little bit different. We have a little stat spinner. So what I'm going to do is enter it into a little tube. It's about half a mil or so, and put in our little stat spinner. Once you spin it, you see that little pellet at the bottom, and then we're going to pour off that supernatant. So gently open up the top of that tube, and we're going to dump that in the sink and discard it. But when you gently dump it out, you don't lose all of the fluid. There is a little bit of fluid that will remain in that sample tube itself, as we see here in the video. And then we're going to take our little pipette, and we're going to mix it up again, just to kind of get that all back together. Now it'll be a much higher cellularity and cell count for me to look at. Once it's mixed up, I'll place a drop on a slide, and then we're going to smear just gently. We're not going to smush those cells. We'll place that other slide you see on the right-hand side or the ventral side of the video screen just right on top of it gently, and we're going to then just smear it to the end. Now, I personally like to stop right before the end of the slide just so I don't drag the cells off. I'm an ER person, so I'm impatient. I don't never let anything air dry. I'll use my hair dryer, and then I'll use my DiffQuick technique to go ahead and dip it in my three different containers, and then we'll again let that dry off, and we'll take a look at that under the microscope. In general, that takes a good, 3 minutes or so, but it gives me the opportunity as the clinician on the floor dealing with that case to go ahead and give my cursory assessment of what I am dealing with, because sometimes waiting even 24 hours can be detrimental for that patient, and we'll review certain cases where that would absolutely be a detriment to that patient. So now we have our patient that has pleural effusion, and we have to decide as clinicians what the causes may be. And I love this small chart or example slide, because to me, not only it makes sense from a practical standpoint, because I will tell you this is what the study shows, but this is what I see from a clinical standpoint as well. This was from a retrospective analysis looking at pleural effusion in cats. Data was collected from 305 cats diagnosed with pleural effusion at the Clinic of Small Animal Medicine in Munich, Germany between 2000 and 2009, and cats were included in this study if a definitive diagnosis was established, and they were then put into one of six groups. As you see on this slide here, we have cardiomyopathy, feline infectious peritonitis, cancer, neoplasia, pyothorax, chylothorax, and other diseases. So in this study, cardiomyopathy was diagnosed most frequently at just under 30%, followed by cancer at just under 30% as well. My take home here is if I have a middle-aged to older cat with pleural effusion, my thought number one is heart failure until proven otherwise, with cancer being second on the list. Another take-home point is if I had a younger cat, not middle-aged to older, But younger, the two things that would come to my mind right away would be FIP, feline infectious peritonitis, and pyothorax. And then patients with, for example, chylothorax, how does that make sense to me? Well, immediately, I'm telling that family these are a little bit more challenging cases, and they tend to be in the hospital longer because it doesn't respond to one dose, one treatment, one pill, one injection of a medication. They're just a little bit more challenging cases. And again, this study to me is great because it backs up from an objective standpoint my subjective or my clinical experience that yes, heart failure and cancer are most frequent reasons for pleural effusion in cats. So if I have a middle-aged older cat, again, take-home point, heart failure and cancer, one and two easiest on my list right at the top, and we'll then disprove that and rule out everything else following those two thought processes. But what about dogs? Are dogs similar to cats as far as causes of pleural effusion? My answer is yes and no. So my take-home point for dogs with pleural effusion is it's rarely, if ever, primary heart disease related. So if you think about valvular disease in your smaller breed dogs, DCM or pericardial effusion in your bigger breed dogs, we just don't commonly see pleural effusion in those patients. So if I see pleural effusion in a dog as compared to a cat, cats, heart failure until proven otherwise. Dogs, unlikely to be heart failure. So in dogs, what am I thinking about? Well, in dogs, I'm thinking about certainly age-related cancer, infection or pyothorax, any type of third spacing disease, for example, your protein losing diseases where you have low oncotic pressure, your protein losing enteropathies, your protein losing nephropathies, chylothorax, if it's blood, for example, rodenticide versus trauma versus other, right? Cancer being on the list, which we'll talk about. But yes, less likely heart-related specific disease. We just don't see heart disease cause pleural effusion in dogs. With that in mind, again, I talked a couple slides ago about doing some crude testing, some initial evaluation for these patients. And for me, yes, one is just based on color and general turbidity. Look at the sample with your eyes. Use your good clinical judgment. Of course, a complete fluid analysis and cytology is going to be needed at some point. Looking at nucleated cell counts, looking at erythrocytes, total protein, and then, yes, microscopic evaluation. But you can get a quick and dirty assessment with your own eyes. For example, a transitate, and we'll talk about that coming up, it's more likely to be clear and colorless. But if I had a gross, turbid, dark color sample, yeah, maybe I'm dealing with an exudate, right? So before I do any fancy testing, even cytology, I'm going to look with my eyes. What am I dealing with? Is it bloody? Is it clear? Is it cloudy or turbid? Is it icteric? Is there anything that can help me right now deal with this dysmic patient? So let's talk first about transitate. So we're going to try to differentiate as well, not only with our gross look with our eyes, but also with our cytology that we look at in a little refractometer assessment. What am I dealing with? How can I better help the patient right now? Could it be a transitate? So for small animals, our transitates are typically defined as effusions with a total nucleated cell count of approximately less than 1,000 to 1,500 cells per microliter and a lower total protein, less than about 2.5 grams per deciliter. So when you evaluate these samples cytologically, you're going to see, yeah, maybe there's some macrophages, maybe a small amount of neutrophils with a little bit of chronicity, but it's going to be a low cell count and a low protein level in those transitates. If I do think I have a transitate, what am I thinking about, and therefore how do I better treat and test my patient? I'm thinking about things like protein losing conditions, our PLEs or our PLNs, some type of increased hydrostatic pressure or fluid overload, congestive heart failure. Remember, in our cat, because we're talking about pleural effusion, dogs don't really do this with heart failure, any type of vascular obstruction, or even systemic hypertension. Then you have patients which fall into the middle category. So the middle category usually has one up and one down, so to speak, so they can have a higher cell count, lower protein, or flip that, a higher protein and a lower cell count. So But in general, we're talking about lower, in general, total nucleated cell counts, less than 5,000 cells per microliter or so, and a total protein that is usually less than 2.5 grams per deciliter. But again, if you have a very low cell count, sometimes you can have a little bit of a higher protein, and it still fit in this category. The predominant cell type in these effusions can vary, again, neutrophils and mononucleated cells predominating. So as the name implies, some of these effusions are from transitative processes which have been modified by the addition of either proteins or cells. And what are possible causes for this? Heart failure, again, remembering our cat. Early chylus effusion, maybe early cancer without a significant inflammatory response, and two others that start to then approach this list that are not on my previous list as much are either diaphragmatic hernia or lung lobe torsions. And then finally, on the opposite end of the spectrum, you have our exudates. And these effusions usually have a high cell count, greater than 5,000 cells per microliter, and generally a higher total protein, greater than 2.5 to 3 grams per deciliter, with a predominant cell type being the neutrophil. Causes for exudates include things like FIP, severe chylus or chronic chylus disease, very significant infectious or inflammatory responses, so pyothorax, cancers, or things like diaphragmatic hernia or lung lobe torsions, which have been a little bit more chronic in nature and therefore have given a little bit greater of an inflammatory response. So reviewing, I want to talk about just a couple of these in specific from a clinical standpoint. Again, I try to be very clinically relevant and practical. What do I see in practice from this list that I want you to evaluate cytologically and why that's important that we talked about doing our in-house cytology? One is chylus effusion, because to me, when this is an actual dog that I got chylus effusion from, and it was about 4 liters of effusion from this greyhound's chest. Obviously came in significant respiratory distress, but if I have an effusion like this, so it's, as you can see, I call Pepto-Bismol-like, it's that white to pink here in the screen, opaque fluid. There are two things that come to mind that I want to try to rule out in these cases. One is lymphoma, and the other is chylus disease. Chylus disease is usually, again, white to opaque and pink to milky in color. Usually, it is not infectious, so chyle is bacteriostatic, so an infection associated with chylothorax is very uncommon. I know this is just a small sample of the cytology behind the words, but you do not see any bacteria itself. And we can see in this case there are some macrophages, there are some neutrophils throughout, and there's some. These are small lymphocytes. They're even smaller than the neutrophils that we can see on this screen here. So we're not seeing a significant amount of, for example, any type of neoplastic process, for example. We're not seeing large lymphocytes. We're not seeing infectious agents. What are causes of chylothorax in our small animal patients? Well, it can be actually a cancerous process, which does this, a mediastinal lymphoma, an obstructive process, heart failure more in our feline patients, heartworm disease, thromboembolic disease, thoracic duct rupture, or thoracic lymphangiectasia. Unfortunately, we can also see idiopathic chylothorax in cats. I'm not going to review the surgical treatment of this disease. It's outside of the scope of the lecture this afternoon, but I'm a criticalist. I'm an ER person, not a surgeon. Many ask about Rutin. How does Rutin work for this disease? Well, it's a common choice because it's reported to increase reabsorption and decrease production of chyle. But if you read into what I'm saying here, versus a heart failure cat, for example, or dog, again, without pleural effusion, but that's often a quick fix. Within 12 to 24 hours, those patients are better. When I talk about Rutin, it's reported to increase reabsorption and decrease production, but it's not that definitive take-home, going to make things immediately better. There's a lot of diagnostics we need to consider, and that's why if I can diagnose this, just doing some quick cytology in our patient, I can talk to that client while they're in the ER, while they're in your hospital for discussion and say, listen, this is going to be a little bit longer of a process. I want to send this fluid out to a pathologist to make sure they agree it's not lymphoma. And then we need to do blood work. We need to do full fluid evaluation. We need to do an echocardiogram. We need to do an ultrasound. We need to do X, Y, and Z. Even as I have in this slide here, how else can we further diagnose this? Well, we can measure, for example, triglyceride values. So usually triglyceride values greater than 95 milligrams per deciliter or a pleural fluid to serum triglyceride ratio being greater than 10 is often diagnostic for this condition. What is another common disease that I see in practice of pleural effusion that I want cytology on? I don't want to wait to get that answer in 24 or 48 hours, and that's a pyothorax. So this is not only the fluid that I obtained, but the x-ray after, as you can see there, hopefully chest tubes that I had in a cat with pleural effusion. So pyothorax is a medical term for bacterial infections of the pleural space leading to accumulation of what? Purulent fluid in both our dogs and cats. But the disease is often different as far as its origin or cause between the species. When I have a dog that has a pyothorax, many consider the entry of foreign material such as grass awns into the thoracic cavity. Cats, on the other hand, I usually ask, are they indoor, outdoor, or is it a multi-cat household? Because often it's a fight between cat and cat or cat and dog, for example, which leads to this. With that said, in many cases, I'm going to be honest, thorough investigation, you come up empty-handed without a specific cause. When we think about, though, our pathogens, because if I have pyothorax, I have to know, what am I treating? Well, what are common bacteria identified in pyothorax? We can have Pasteurella, Bacteroides, Actinomyces, Clostridium, Nocardia, and often infections are mixed, not even with this, excuse me, one specific patient. When I have that fluid, is often a white to beige to pink and red, malodorous. This fluid, if this was smell-o-vision coming through your computer now, this would stink. It's often very malodorous. We can see on the cytology on the left-hand side of the screen, degenerate neutrophils predominate, and we see bacteria. So right where that little microscope slide is pointing to, those are lovely rod-type bacteria, and these patients are often systemically ill and can even present septic. How am I going to diagnose this? Well, sometimes what you can do is you can actually evaluate the purulent fluid itself with a couple of values. We can go ahead and measure, for example, the combination of blood glucose versus the glucose in the effusion versus the lactate of the effusion versus the lactate of the blood. So a very good opportunity, as well as, of course, our cytology. Because cytology, to me, is the gold standard. If I diagnose not only neutrophils but bacteria present, that is diagnostic, slam dunk, pyothorax, and we need to decide what the next steps are. My experience would tell me that dogs with a pyothorax are usually surgical, meaning a thoracotomy to look for an origin as well as to flush out the chest, whereas cats are more likely to be medical, meaning chest tubes, cultures, antibiotics, etc. And then the last example of a specific type of fluid that I want to talk about here is true blood. If I have blood within my pleural space, there are two things that I'd like to view and rule out very quickly. One is trauma. Now, trauma is often very easy to rule out for most of our patients. Usually if it's traumas, for example, vehicular trauma, being hit by a car, those owners often come running into your hospital with a dog or cat in their arms saying, my pet was hit by a car, and they come screaming back. If they don't do that, usually trauma is not very high on the list. As I tell owners, if dogs develop blood in a cavity, belly or chest, for example, just from roughhousing, every patient you would see in the hospital would have blood within body cavity. So it's not just simple roughhousing. The second thing I want to rule out is coagulopathy, for example, anticoagulant rodenticide toxicity. So I'll do a PT and potentially PT prothrombin and PTT test, looking to make sure there's no evidence of a coagulopathy. But if we can rule those out, so if it is truly a non-traumatic, non-coagulopathic patient that comes into the hospital, What am I thinking about? Well, I am unfortunately thinking about cancer. So this was a small study done out of Tufts University in the Boston area, where when they had a non-traumatic, non-coagulopathic patient, so they had blood in the thoracic cavity that was not due to trauma, not due to a clotting problem, what is the most common cause? The most common cause, especially in dogs, was cancer, cancer, cancer. And I've absolutely had numerous patients that have come in with this, and I will tell you, my personal experience and my hindsight would be two things. One is, I've often missed and then found it later. On palpation, I find that sort of there's a missing rib from lysis of tumor of the rib, which has become lytic. And when I look at that x-ray afterwards, I see this lysis and a missing part of a rib there. So it just goes to show you how important your physical examination can be. If I had been more astute on that, I could have even picked that up on my palpation. Boy, there's a painful area, a missing rib. I'm really worried this is due to cancer. Let's get an x-ray. Let's do our thoracocentesis. So a good thing to think about when you diagnose pleural effusion. And it is hemorrhagic pleural effusion. So that was my sort of whirlwind tour of pleural effusion in our cats and dogs. So take home points here that I want to quickly review. Number one, I want you to diagnose clinically significant pleural space disease on auscultation and thoracocentesis. Do not stress out that dysmic respiratory distress, sick pleural effusion, pleural space disease patient by getting an x-ray. You should know this pleural space disease based on your visual exam, history, and auscultation, then perform your thoracocentesis. But don't increase the risk of morbidity and mortality getting that essentially useless thoracic x-ray that is covered up by pleural effusion. Secondly, remember in cats, top two differentials, heart failure and cancer. And remember in dogs, heart failure is an unlikely cause of pleural effusion. All right, so let's move on to our second body cavity, our abdomen. Here we can clearly see a patient with a severely distended abdomen. This is when I most commonly use not only my examination, right, but I commonly use the ultrasound in my emergency room setting. And I'm not a radiologist. I don't have either the same training nor the objective as a radiologist when I use the ultrasound machine that I have in practice. I'm not assessing minutiae, for example, adrenal size. I want the quick and dirty. I want obvious masses, effusions, or disease that can be both life-threatening and aid in quick diagnosis and our therapy options. So how do I use ultrasound in my clinical setting? Well, I'm going to use what's called the FAST protocol. It's known as the Focused Assessment with Sonography for Trauma, FAST. And you see on the left side of the screen, it now has a superscript 3. So it's not only trauma, it's triage, tracking, and trauma. This has been used in both human and veterinary medicine. It's a rapid tool for assessment of blunt and penetrating trauma, as well as other non-specific reasons for emergency room presentation, such as the dog that I showed you on the previous slide with a very distended abdomen. FAST can also be used for our hospitalized patients. It's a bedside diagnostic tool to monitor for progression of disease, the tracking part I talked about, or investigate our acute clinical decompensation. So referring here specifically to our abdominal FAST protocol, our AFAST, we're going to evaluate our abdominal cavity and our retroperitoneal space. And the AFAST uses four standard views for the evaluation with our patient. And when the studies when the study was being looked at for this, the patient was in right lateral recumbency. If we start around the left side of your screen and then go clockwise around the table, what are the four views that we talk about? Well, the first all the way on the left side of your screen is what's called the DH view, the diaphragmatic hepatic, otherwise known as the subxiphoid view. And that's going to evaluate the hepatic diaphragmatic interface, our gallbladder, or also our pericardial sac, and potentially some of our pleural space. Going clockwise now to the top of your screen, the splenorenal view is going to evaluate the area between the spleen and the body wall. Now going clockwise all the way to the right, we have our cystocolic, or our CC view. That's going to evaluate the midline bladder view to assess the apex of the bladder and any effusion around the bladder. And then finally, at the bottom of the screen, we have our HR view, or the hepatorenal interface, which will evaluate the areas between our intestinal loops, our liver, and our kidney. And so these are now examples on the left side of your screen of the specific views, all with abnormalities. So we can see anechoic black effusion around those organs in question, and that's the abnormality that we are looking for in these cases. Okay, so we've identified our abdominal effusion. How are we going to then obtain this sample? So that, and that can be both therapeutic and diagnostic, just like pleural effusion that we reviewed earlier. Well, we need to do an abdominocentesis, and that can be performed a couple of different ways. We can do what's called a blind abdominocentesis. That's without any visualization, any ultrasound, for example. We can do our four-quadrant abdominocentesis, or ideally, I like using ultrasound-guided abdominocentesis because it shows you exactly where you need to stick your needle and even identify small pockets of effusion that may be more challenging if you're just sticking a needle in blindly or randomly trying to get a effusion. If you are going to perform a blind abdominocentesis, I like having the patient in right lateral recumbency with the entry point being approximately 2 to 3 centimeters caudal to the umbilicus and, 2 to 3 centimeters from the midline in the dependent region. The reason I do that is because if the patient's in right lateral recumbency, accidental puncture or laceration of the spleen is less likely. If you look sort of at the right side picture with those four X's or the little image on the bottom of the screen, you see that bottom X, for example. What's being shown there is the four quadrant technique. It gives you a little bit more opportunity to get a sample without ultrasound rather than one single blind needle stick. How do you perform that? Well, we're going to do our clip and aseptic scrub for the patient, and then needles are going to be placed in four quadrants: cranial and left, cranial and right, caudal and left, caudal and right, as compared to the umbilicus. So although the patient is in dorsal recumbency in that top right image, you see the umbilicus, that tiny little bulge in the middle, and then we have those four X's. It's kind of like our treasure hunt X's. If no fluid is flowing freely, a 3 mL syringe can be attached to those needles to allow a little bit of gentle pressure, a little gentle suctioning with our negative pressure, repeating on all four quadrants as necessary. But hopefully, you at least get a little bit of fluid during your abdominocentesis, whether it's blind, four quadrant, or ultrasound guided, because similar to our conversation before, we need to do our diagnostic and cytology prep that we learned about in our previous video and slides to determine what we are dealing with. Again, I like doing this because sometimes it can be detrimental to the patient to wait 24 or 48 hours, even if you're going to send it out to a boarded pathologist to review. We talked about pyothorax in our pleural effusion case. That obviously I would not want to wait to start antibiotics on for 24 or 48 hours. What if you had a septic abdomen? So in our septic abdomen, similar to our conversation before, we can do a couple of things. So sure, we can use our cytology prep skills, our gold standard, to make our slide and evaluate for the presence of bacteria. But even we can get a little bit more of a clue and cue that this could be a septic abdomen by measuring values. And here's a study that came out some time ago. This is a 2003 study, but still holds true. In our septic patients, the blood glucose concentration is greater in the blood, of course, blood glucose, than our abdominal fluid glucose concentration by at least 20 milligrams per deciliter, and our lactate concentrations were 2 milligrams per deciliter higher in the effusion as compared to your peripheral blood. And those together, of course, are indicative of our septic peritonitis. So if I diagnose this as septic abdomen, and I can't think of a reasonable case with a septic abdomen that is not a surgical emergency, certainly requiring more diagnostics and likely an explore, not a case I want to sit on in the hospital for 24 or 48 hours waiting for a clinical pathologist to get me that information. What about a uroabdomen? So in these cases, What are we going to look at? Well, cytology alone is unlikely to be helpful. We'll talk about that more in the next slide or two. But you can't see urine, so to speak, right? You can see bacteria from sepsis. But how are we going to evaluate a uroabdomen if you're worried about a bladder or urethral rupture, for example? Well, there are two things we're going to compare. Not glucose and lactate like our septic patient, but potassium and creatinine. We do not compare BUN. BUN is such a small, easily and freely diffusible molecule that it's too hard to evaluate. It equilibrates way too rapidly. But potassium and creatinine are what we look at. Now, as you compare the two together, potassium is a smaller, more readily diffusible molecule as compared to creatinine. So if you're peeing into your abdominal cavity, which is, of course, a problem, potassium being a smaller molecule will diffuse into the bloodstream easier, which is why the ratio is smaller. So for example, if we're urinating into our abdomen because our bladder is ruptured, yes, the potassium in the abdominal fluid will be higher, but about 1.4 times that in the effusion as compared to the blood. And then 1.9 in cats. So 1.4 in the dog, 1.9 in the cat. But creatinine being a much larger molecule and not easily as diffusible back and forth, your creatinine in your abdomen, in your abdominal effusion, will be at least 2 times greater. And that has 100% specificity and an 86% sensitivity in studies. But let's put this into a clinical setting. So this is a case that we saw in practice. Here we have our patient we called Phoenix, who is a 3-year-old male castrated Labrador that presented to the ER with an acute concern for vomiting. And you may be saying to yourself, sure, it's a 3-year-old Labrador. What kind of sock or tennis ball did he eat, right? And you could send him home with medication and subcutaneous fluids. Well, not so fast, right? He didn't give us much to go on. There's no past medical history. He was up to date on vaccines, but he can roam free on a 2-acre wooded lot. And he was normal just a few hours ago. As you get more of a history from the owners, they tell you that they were on a boat recently on a nearby lake, and there was, I believe, yesterday or the day prior, I should say, nothing was abnormal. But in passing, they say, listen, Phoenix did go to sort of jump off the boat, and when he did, he slipped, and yeah, they didn't witness the event, but they heard him swimming happily in the water. He wasn't on the dock as they expected him to be. When he comes into your hospital, he had severe abdominal pain and splinting. And if we look at that top picture, that's not Phoenix. That was a boxer that I had in practice, a boxer dog. But he had what's called their prayer position. So we see them sort of bowing down. So it's not a play bow because their abdomen's super painful. That's called their prayer position. And then we get blood work on Phoenix. So let's take like 5 seconds or so to look at this blood work. What are we seeing? Take a quick look. And then I'll start describing. All right, so if you look at that pH 7.2, normal is about 7.35 to 7.45, so that is low. We certainly have an acidosis. Can't tell you why just yet, but we certainly need more information there. But as we look at some of the other values, base excess is very low, negative 17. Normal is about negative 4 to plus 4. The more negative it is, the more of an acid response it is. And other things that I clearly see on this one, lactate is high at 6.7. The urea was so high they couldn't even get it. And look at that potassium, 10.2. On the right side of the screen, we have an EKG. And what you see, that top peak, that is a tall tented T wave right after that QRS complex. So I'm starting to really worry about that potassium. Why is that elevated? Why do we have that acidosis? And why do we have that significant base excess negative? And why is that urea so darn high? So we do our little fast ultrasound that we talked about because we have a patient with severe and splinting abdominal pain, and we see fluid present. We do an abdominocentesis, and you could be saying to yourself, I'm looking at this slide. I'm looking at this fluid that I obtained in my 3cc syringe. Wow, that is blood. This patient has a hemoabdomen. But something's not making a ton of sense to me. I would tell you that most of my hemoabdomen patients don't come in with severe and splinting, abdominal pain and abdominal concern there. So something's not a gross evaluation, but you need more information to really say, is this true hemorrhage or not? And even as I put this fluid in my little hematocrit, my little microhematocrit tube, you can easily see right away that's not as bloody as you would expect. It often has that now, like what I would call serosanguinous view to me. That's not going to be frank blood itself. And even when we spin that down, our peripheral blood being 33 and then abdominal effusion was only 13%. So we pair and compare our samples together. So not true hemorrhage. I'm going to call that likely serosanguinous. Sure, there are red blood cells there. But I'm not ready to call this a primary hemoabdomen at this point. So what are we going to do now? Well, we have to use our cytology prep skills that we learned about earlier. And what are we seeing on here? Some red blood cells, some white blood cells. But what are those chain things? Those are bacteria. So does this make sense for our patient? We have red blood cells, white blood cells, bacteria, high potassium, high BUN. Lactic acidosis. What are we dealing with here? Well, if we compare our peripheral blood to our abdominal effusion, does this make sense? Why was this patient azotemic? Well, what I decided, what my running theory was on this patient was this patient probably jumped off the boat, hit the dock, and ruptured their bladder and developed a uroabdomen. I've certainly seen cases before where the patient had a UTI, then bladder trauma, and now we have a septic uroabdomen. So we can evaluate our potassium and creatinine like we talked about earlier. So if we look at our abdominal fluid had a potassium of 10.6, and our peripheral blood it was 5.1. Remember, your ratio is greater than 1.4 times, is it? Absolutely, it's over 2 times. If you look at our creatinine, our ratio in our abdominal fluid versus peripheral blood is 2 times in the abdominal fluid. Does that work out? Absolutely. So this patient was likely a traumatic, now septic, uroabdomen. Again, why we don't just look at the fluid with our eyes, we do our cytology prep skills, and why we critically evaluate our cytology and our blood samples. So this to me is not a zebra case. A zebra case is something I've only seen once in my life. I've seen these cases numerous times, whether it's a combined septic uroabdomen or a uroabdomen in general. I had a case about a month ago of an elderly couple that were walking up the stairs, and the dog zoomed up next to them, startled the owner who fell on the dog. That dog went to the primary care veterinarian, received a dose of an NSAID because he was limping, and then came into me 24 hours later, super sick. What happened? Similar to this case, trauma and a traumatic uroabdomen. So make sure we are critically evaluating our patients. Phoenix here in our great example, yep, our traumatic septic uroabdomen. So let's move on to our third body cavity that we're going to be talking about today. That's our pericardial space and our pericardial effusion, which is a life-threatening condition seen commonly in the ER. Immediate treatment, like our pleural effusion cases, immediate treatment for our pericardial effusion can be both diagnostic as well as life-saving, quickly alleviating their distress, improving their cardiovascular stability. What are you going to find on your examination to clue you in that there could be pericardial effusion? Well, when you examine them, use your hands, use your eyes, use your ears. When you feel their pulses, they typically have weak and/or variable pulses, and they're often tachycardic. When you auscult them, their heartbeat sounds dull because you're listening through all of that effusion. It sounds dull and distant, not as crisp, for example, as those normal heart sounds that you're used to hearing. And that's going to support the notion this pericardial effusion because you have a very difficult time hearing the heart. Their mucous membrane color is often pale with a prolonged capillary refill time as they have poor cardiac output. As a result of poor circulation, some of them can even be hypothermic, a low body temperature. If it's been more chronic in nature, ascites from right-sided heart disease, right-sided tamponade can certainly be present, as well as hepatosplenomegaly. And then we can also see jugular distension and maybe pulsus paradoxus when you palpate and when you hook up an EKG. How am I going to approach this? Well, it's going to be influenced by your available equipment and or your staff. Not everyone has ultrasound in practice. I totally understand that. So aside from your exam, thoracic x-rays can be super helpful to evaluate our cardiac size and shape. When I look at this, there are two things that come to mind. One is pericardial effusion, and the other would be DCM, dilated cardiomyopathy. Now, if I do have ultrasound capability, which would be great in this case, because I cannot, in full disclosure, 100% differentiate DCM from pericardial effusion based on this alone, but if I do have the availability to do ultrasound and I have pericardial effusion and that patient is clinical, my next step is going to be to perform a pericardiocentesis. So I'm going to quickly describe the procedure to you and then show you a video of it being performed. How do I like to place my patient? Well, similar to my conversation about pleural effusion, I feel they are less distressed in sternal recumbency, and also in sternal recumbency, their heart does not fall away from you. If I, as you see here, head is to the right, tail is to the left, if I place them left lateral recumbency, the heart's going to fall away from me. So dual purpose, I like them in sternal recumbency. Anesthesia in these cases is not necessary, although I will say mild sedation, for example, with an opioid benzodiazepine combination can be helpful for mild chemical restraint. And then I'll give them a lidocaine block to reduce discomfort at the local site as well. Where are we going to go? Well, ultrasound will tell you where you should go, but typically remember where the heart sits based on our previous conversation. The heart should sit between the approximate fourth and sixth intercostal spaces. I like tapping them on the right side of the thorax. It often gives a better window. Similar to our principles of our thoracocentesis, how are we going to do this? Well, again, fourth to sixth intercostal space, sort of mid to distal third of the chest wall. While not mandatory, some clinicians like to make a stab incision with an 11 blade to prevent skin drag as you enter your catheter, your needle, through the skin itself. And then I'm going to hook them up to ECG right away, even before I do this. Once you're within the pleural space, we're going to slowly advance our catheter 1 to 2 millimeters at a time towards the heart, continuously monitoring our patient for discomfort and the ECG for arrhythmias. And then we're going to watch carefully for fluid accumulation into the hub of the catheter. Once we do see a little fluid accumulation into the hub of the catheter, like placing a peripheral IV catheter, you're going to advance just another millimeter or two to make sure we really are seated within our pericardial space. We will then remove our stylet, hook up to our extension tubing through a stopcock, and then our syringe to aspirate the fluid. We'll immediately put some of the fluid into a clotting normal tube, for example, a white or red topped tube, to see if it clots. You should not see it clot, because those clotting factors have already been used up in our pericardial space. One other comment is that the most common side effect from this procedure is ventricular tachycardia, from sort of tickling the heart. So prior to doing the procedure, obviously catheter, we need fluids, EKG, but I will get out the bottle of lidocaine, I will calculate a 2 milligram per kilogram lidocaine dose, and I will know how many milliliters to give this patient if they do go into VTAC. So we're not running around looking for the fluid, lidocaine, running around looking for the calculator, running around looking for syringes. We will be prepared. So let's watch the video and I'll talk through it again, giving a second exposure. So again, sternal recumbency, tapping from the right side of the chest. The patient is already hooked up to our EKG. So we're monitoring heart rate. Usually they are fairly tachycardic. I would say 170 to 200 beats per minute is very common when they're in tamponade. As I enter, you see we have a little bit of blood coming through our hub. Once we see that little bit of blood, we're going to then just a millimeter or two more push this catheter into the pericardial space and then slide that stylet off. Once we slide the stylet out of the catheter itself, we will then hook up to our extension set, which has a 3-way stopcock and a syringe at the end. You'll see the person aspirate, the assistant aspirate the blood into the syringe, and then immediately what they're going to do is put some into our red top or clotting tube to make sure it does not clot. If it clots, the concern would be maybe you entered the ventricle rather than actually the pericardial space accidentally. So we'll sort of invert that and go up and down a couple of times. We will be watching the EKG throughout this process to make sure that we're not seeing any arrhythmias. We will also often precipitously and rapidly see the heart rate start to improve. They often go from a heart rate of 170 to 200 down to, let's say, 150, 140, and then 130 and lower pretty quickly as you resolve their tamponade and improve their cardiac function. So here on the screen, we're already down to about 150. You'll start to see on the EKG here a couple of VPCs that pop in. Now, VPCs are not a reason to start treating with lidocaine. You want to make sure it's not runs of VTAC. Now, I often know that VPCs are going to be present because I can feel the heart tickle my catheter like sandpaper. If that happens, I will gently, millimeter at a time, back out my catheter and see if we can still aspirate just a little bit. And the heart rate will continue to drop throughout this process as we aspirate. So a quick review of pericardial effusion. Now don't forget, you still have to evaluate this fluid, right? Principles of diagnostic evaluation remain similar to what we discussed earlier. Most of the time for our patients, it's going to be hemorrhagic. So yes, we should make sure that it's hemorrhage, run a PCB total protein. If it truly is hemorrhagic, like true blood, your PCB is 30, 35, 40, something like that, you can still do cytology, but most of the time you're just going to see red blood cells. When it becomes important is when the PCV is less than 12 to 13%. I round it up and say anything less than 15%, I'm definitely going to do cytology. And just under 10%, you see here 7.7% of the time, you can actually get an answer. So here is a pericardial effusion sample that I got, which was a neoplastic process that wasn't your common atrial or auricular hemangiosarcoma. So if you spin down your PCV tube and you get less than, let's say, 15%, make sure you consider cytology. It could be septic, it could be lymphoma, it could be mesothelioma, or other causes. So absolutely remember your principles of fluid evaluation, even with your pericardial samples. Doesn't surprise me, or my take-home points here in these cases regarding prognosis are, think about your average life expectancies. It would certainly make sense in dogs with more chronic disease, those, for example, with ascites, where the pericardium has had time to stretch over a period of time, they are going to have a longer and better prognosis, whereas your acute, severe, life-threatening bleeds without warning. So that patient that comes in acutely collapsed, acutely sick, they are going to have a worse prognosis. So nice information to consider when talking to a client about what to expect in the future. So yes, we can do a pericardiocentesis, but what does it mean both short and long term? And then finally, with the last couple of minutes, I'm going to look into our last cavity. This is, as you can probably tell from what I did, pleural effusion is the most common thing I see in practice, followed by abdominal effusion, followed by pericardial effusion, and then primary retroperitoneal disease is the last and least common type of effusion that I see in clinical practice. So this was a canine patient with significant retroperitoneal disease. Here was a feline patient with retroperitoneal disease on x-rays. So what are these patients going to look like? Well, they are going to come in maybe with abdominal pain, dehydration, depression, lethargy, weakness. As we can see in the slide here, my take-home point is that retroperitoneal effusions, regardless of the cause, is typically associated with significant disease. We can see causes, for example, including cancer, primary renal disease, and primary adrenal disease. These are cases where ultrasound is often helpful, but we can see certainly on the previous two slides how x-rays can further evaluate and give you important information. The one thing that I would say is that make sure we rule out two things quickly. One is pyelonephritis or renal disease and or renal or ureteral and or urethral obstruction, those would carry a better prognosis than certainly a hemorrhagic retroperitoneal effusion and the risk for cancer, whether it's renal or adrenal in those cavities. But retroperitoneal effusion and retroperitoneal disease in general is certainly, at least in my experience, less common as compared to the three we reviewed earlier. And then finally, wrapping it up, what happens when the effusion is not isolated to just one body cavity? Is there information we can take away if there are multiple body cavity effusions? Well, this was based on an ACVIM retrospective study that was published in 2011, and the goal of this study was to identify common underlying causes of multi-cavitary effusions, as well as determine the relative importance of these effusions. And not surprisingly, at least to me, if I had a patient that had effusions in multiple body cavities, especially middle-aged to older, cancer is going to be the most common underlying cause, with hemangiosarcoma being the leading type, followed by other things, congestive heart failure, especially in cats, protein-losing diseases, for example, gastrointestinal lymphangiectasia, protein-losing enteropathy, protein-losing nephropathy, any type of major inflammatory responses like a peritonitis or pancreatitis, liver disease, and acute renal failure for sure. And then, of course, there are going to be some cases where the study could not find an underlying cause. But again, middle-aged, older, if I have a multi-body cavity effusion, pleural and pericardial, pleural and abdominal, et cetera, I unfortunately am worried about cancer first. So taken together, of course, these findings suggest a strong association between multi-cavitary effusions and diseases that carry a poor to guarded prognosis, especially in our small animal patients. With that said, I certainly hope that you've enjoyed today's effusion discussion, and I hope that it clears up some of that effusion confusion for our small animal patients. I wanted to thank you all for joining, whether it's today live or whether it's in the future at the recording. Certainly happy to answer any questions that anyone may have. But again, thank you for taking the time to join me in delivering this session today.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Gareth for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.